love to ever live. My heart should be well schooled.
From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Stephanie Coachman with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, January 30th. A new international study involving Florida scientists finds harmful algae blooms are expanding worldwide, driven by warming waters and excess nutrient pollution. Researchers warn the blooms threaten drinking water, fisheries, tourism, and marine ecosystems, including Florida's coastal waters. From environmental warning signs across the globe to policy battles unfolding here at home, a Florida House committee has advanced House Bill 693, a measure that would embed a federal restriction blocking Medicaid payments to certain reproductive health providers, including Planned Parenthood. Supporters say the bill aligns Florida law with federal budget provisions passed last year. Opponents warn it could permanently cut off Medicaid patients from cancer screenings, birth control, STI testing, and preventive care, and could force clinic closures statewide. And while health care access is under debate, state government spending is under review. A review by Florida's Department of Government Efficiency, known as DOGE, found wasteful spending in municipal budgets, but no evidence of fraud. Auditors cited inefficiencies and poor oversight. Turning now to education and public health here in South Florida, health officials have confirmed a case of measles in Manatee County. The individual is isolating, and public health officials are urging residents to check vaccination records and contact a healthcare provider if symptoms appear. And staying with local family-focused news, Sarasota County Schools have announced a voluntary pre-kindergarten enrollment window for the 2026-2027 school year. VPK applications open February 2nd through March 2nd. The free program offers both a school year option and a summer option, with extended day services available. Officials encourage families to review school sites early and select the program that best fits their child's needs. And finally today, a reminder that even in cold weather, community care is showing up strong. With frigid temperature continuing, Manatee County is extending cold weather shelter operations through early next week. Shelters at the Salvation Army and Under One Roof will remain open, with free transportation provided and warming centers available during the day. Officials are encouraging residents to spread the word to anyone who may need a safe, warm place. For WSLR, I'm Stephanie Coachman. Stay informed, stay intentional, and as always, stay safe. Enjoy your weekend.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. In spite of the temperature outside, things are heating up for politicians showing up in public. Just this week, Florida Representative Max Frost was punched in the face at the Sundance Film Festival in Utah by a man who told him he should be deported before landing the blow. Minnesota Rep. Ilhan Omar was sprayed with an unknown but rank-smelling substance at a town meeting in her state and was also threatened with deportation. Of course, if you listen to the tales being told by Washington, it is those leftist radical thugs who are proliferating the violence against those victimized ICE and CBP agents, as the former head of the Minnesota attack, Greg Bovino, characterized them. Maybe the increase of attacks on politicians prompted Vern Buchanan's decision to retire after this term. Or was it the reality that the days of just doing what Trump told him to do were over, and now he had to think for himself? Stay tuned until 1:30 to hear my interview with Anders Croy, communications director of Florida Watch, who breaks down some of the issues facing the legislature, including an effort to permit the construction of AI data centers in secret without public oversight, as those projects would diminish water supplies and increase the cost of electricity for citizens. But first, Meta is showing its true colors, censoring efforts by users to track the movements of ICE. Meta is doing President Donald Trump yet another solid in the wake of his federal immigration agent shooting dead two American protesters in the street by censoring a site that identifies them. The self-styled accountability initiative ICE List came to widespread public attention earlier this month after the Daily Beast reported that it had been handed details of about 4,500 ICE and Border Patrol employees, including almost 2,000 frontline agents. The leaked staff roster, which included names, roles, work, emails, and phone numbers, and some resume info, allegedly came from Department of Homeland Security whistleblower, outraged by the killing of unarmed mom Renee Nicole Good, 37, by ICE agent Jonathan Ross, 43. Ever since, ICE List, which says it identifies federal immigration officials because the Trump administration refuses to, has faced roadblocks in its attempts to do so, including a massive cyber attack hours after the Beast's January 13th report. Now, ICE List is being censored by Meta, the owner of Facebook and Threads, just days after a group of as-yet-unidentified Border Patrol agents manhandled and repeatedly blasted to death VA nurse Alex Preddy, 37, on January 24th. Since Monday, whenever anyone attempted to post the website's URLs, WikiIceList.is and IceList.is on these two Meta-owned social media platforms, they encountered an error message saying the links cannot be posted. On Facebook, it says any such post goes against our community standards without giving any further explanation. Meta's censoring of ICE List comes after its owner, Mark Zuckerberg, has repeatedly cozied up to Trump, including contributing to his gaudy $400 million White House ballroom project. The site's founder, Dominic Skinner, thinks the two are linked. He told the Beast, for 6 or 7 months, you could post links on our sites on Meta platforms without any issue. This is an overnight change. It seems to come directly after we posted a link asking for tips related to the murder of Alex Preddy. I believe Mark Zuckerberg is in bed with the regime. He was sitting behind Trump at the inauguration. His algorithms have worked to shape people into right-wing followers, and Meta donated to the Trump ballroom. I don't believe that it's somehow an accident that a company so deeply ingrained in this regime is suddenly blocking a website that actively fights against it. Skinner, who lives in the Netherlands, where he bases the site so it cannot be taken down by the U.S. government, added, "This isn't the first time we have faced any kind of suppression from Meta. Quite regularly, our views on a post will only get a couple hundred views while we're closing in on 200,000 followers. We even have numerous followers who tell us that they have set notifications to see all our posts." A spokesperson for Meta declined to comment, but the company's source said that, according to its privacy policy, Meta removes content that shares or requires private information, whether on its services or through external lists. That includes, the source said, personal contact information, personally identifiable information, such as government IDs of law enforcement, military or security personnel, or residential information. The source added that Meta had taken similar action in the past to restrict content or links that violated standards on sharing or asking for private information. They added that it identified any future instances of personally identifiable information being shared. It would promptly take appropriate action in accordance with our policies and procedures to protect user privacy and ensure compliance with relevant regulations. But Skinner said, we don't share private information, and websites that do can still be shared on Meta's social. I've tested sharing links from other people search websites, and they work fine. So if that's Meta's policy, it only applies to us. You can even share the individual profiles of agents on Meta, and that's not an issue. So their explanation really doesn't hold much weight. Considering who now owns TikTok, no surprise that platform is also restricting anti-ICE content. Comedian Megan Stalter, who posts absurd character skits to an audience in the high hundreds of thousands across Instagram and TikTok, tried sharing a different kind of video on Saturday night. Driven by the death of Alex Preddy, the nurse shot by federal immigration agent or agents that day, she had recorded herself urging her fellow Christians to speak out against ICE raids in Minneapolis. "We have to abolish ICE," Stalter said in the video. "I truly, truly believe that this is exactly what Jesus would do." On Instagram, the video was reposted more than 12,000 times, but her plea never made it to TikTok. In a follow-up post on Instagram, she said she had attempted to upload the video to TikTok several times with no success, then had given up and deleted her TikTok account entirely, believing her content was being censored because it was about ICE. Other users reported the same combination of events, drawing a circumstantial connection between their efforts to make videos about ICE and the difficulties they had posting them over the weekend. The controversy caught the attention of Connecticut Democrat Senator Chris Murphy, who said that among threats to democracy and the purported censorship on TikTok was at the top of their list. TikTok said in a statement that glitches on the app were due to the power outage at a U.S. data center. As a result, a spokesperson for TikTok's U.S. joint venture told CNN, "It's taking longer for videos to be uploaded and recommended to other users." The tech issues were unrelated to last week's news, TikTok said. On Tuesday morning, TikTok joint U.S. joint venture said that it had made significant progress in restoring service to U.S. users, but noted that users may still have trouble uploading new videos. Last week, a majority of American-owned joint venture of the American-owned joint venture took control of TikTok's assets in the United States in a deal shepherded by the Trump administration under a 2024 law requiring the app to move out from under its previous Chinese ownership or face a ban in the United States. Among its new investors is the tech company Oracle, whose executive chair, Larry Ellison, is a close affiliate of President Donald Trump. Oracle will store U.S. TikTok's users' data in a secure U.S. cloud environment, according to TikTok, and the new joint venture will have decision-making authority for trust and safety policies and content moderation. As a private platform, TikTok is free to exert influence on what users can upload and see. Even if accusations of TikTok censorship are unprovable, it's understandable that U.S. users would be increasingly skeptical of the platform in this moment, said Casey Feisler, an associate professor of technology, ethics, and internet law at the University of Colorado in Boulder. There's not a lot of trust in the leadership of social media platforms in general, Feisler told CNN. And given the connection of the new ownership of TikTok to the Trump administration, which is so wrapped up in what is happening and with ICE in Minnesota, it's not surprising that there's a significant lack of trust. Feisler said she was unsurprised about censorship concerns on TikTok, given the timing. Almost immediately after oversight of TikTok's U.S. operations changed, misinformation started to spread about the change to the app's new terms of service, including those that apply to location sharing and data collection, Feisler said. A lot of TikTok users are concerned about what this new ownership means, both with respect to who has access to their data and how content recommendation might change or could change, Feisler said. I think those are valid concerns. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. DOJ's ransom note to Minnesota demanding citizens' info before withdrawing spells out one way it plans to rig the midterms. On Saturday, the same day that federal immigration officer killed Alex Preti in Minneapolis, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi sent a pointed letter to Minnesota Governor Tim Walz stating that if he wanted to bring an end to the chaos in Minnesota, he should comply with some common sense solutions. Those solutions, according to Bondi, included Minnesota providing the Department of Justice with access to the state's complete unredacted voter roll, which includes sensitive personal information like voter social security numbers, driver's license data, and party affiliations. Bondi claimed that the DOJ needed the state's full voter roll in order to confirm Minnesota's voter registration practices comply with federal law. But state election officials and election security experts say Bondi's letter is an outrageous attempt by the Trump administration to coerce Minnesota into providing confidential voter data that could be weaponized by the president and his allies to amplify false claims of voter fraud, wrongfully remove eligible voters from the rolls, and challenge election outcomes. This is simply a disgusting attempt to take attention away from Alex Preti's death, said Joanna Ligate, president of the state's United Democracy Center, a group devoted to fair and secure elections. It's also a shakedown. They're trying now to use the power of the federal government to scare Minnesota officials into handing over voter rolls and backing down on their protective policies. Trump wants the state voter rolls so that he has the ability to interfere with the upcoming midterm elections. Months before, federal immigration agents killed Preti and Renee Good in broad daylight, the DOJ had already requested complete voter rolls from 44 states and Washington, D.C., including Minneapolis, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. Only 11 red states have complied with the request, with others citing federal and state privacy laws that preclude officials from sharing voters' personal information. Not to mention the fact that states are in charge of running their own elections under the Constitution. The DOJ has since sued 24 states and counting, including Minnesota, which ranks highest in the country for state voter turnout and is often lauded as a model for having robust election security protocols. It is deeply disturbing that the U.S. Attorney General would make this unlawful request a part of an apparent ransom to pay for our state's peace and security. As Mother Jones reported in December, these requests and lawsuits are part of a decades-long history of right-wing activists seeking private voter data to advance the unproven narrative that there is rampant non-citizen voter fraud proliferating across the U.S., that the DOJ is now using its considerable resources to promote the same repeated debunked theory represents a major escalation of these tactics. As Maine Secretary of State Sheena Bellows, who has been sued by the DOJ for voter roll data, told us, the Department of Justice has the power to investigate, prosecute, and place people in jail. Bondi's letter raises the stakes of the DOJ's demands for state voter roll data even further, according to the Minnesota Secretary of State, Steve Simon, by suggesting that ICE will leave Minneapolis only if the state capitulates to the administration's demands. It is deeply disturbing that the U.S. Attorney General would make this unlawful request as part of an apparent ransom to pay for our state's peace and security, he said in a statement Sunday. The administration appears to want the voter data in order to construct an unprecedented national database of all registered voters, which it would share with the Department of Homeland Security. Such a database could be a prime target for hackers and could easily be weaponized to spread false claims of illegal voting, which could then be used to remove eligible voters from the rolls and challenge election outcomes. Big surprise. The White House is against agents wearing body cameras. President Donald Trump's administration opposed efforts to expand the use of body cameras by immigration officers and sharply cut oversight staffing as it surged officers into Minneapolis and other cities, leading to a series of violent clashes. Footage from bystanders of two fatal shootings of U.S. citizen protesters, including on January 24th, when an ICU nurse was killed, has underscored the power of video in checking official statements that have portrayed people who have been shot as provoking violent encounters with immigration officers. Cameras worn by officers long have been central to police reform efforts for this reason. The Trump administration, however, moved last year to slow walk a pilot program to give ICE officers body cameras, urging Congress in June to cut the funding by 75% and bucking a nationwide trend of cameras for law enforcement. Officials last year also placed on paid leave nearly all staffers working for three internal watchdogs conducting oversight of immigration agencies, undermining their capacity to investigate abuses. Darius Reeves, who was the director of ICE's Baltimore field office until August, said a body camera pilot program rollout had been slowed in 2024 under President Joe Biden and died on the vine under Trump, a Republican. In response to a request for comment, White House spokesperson Abigail Jackson said ICE officers act heroically to enforce the law and protect American communities. Anyone pointing the finger at law enforcement officers instead of the criminals is simply doing the bidding of criminal illegal aliens, she said. At least three of the eight or more Border Patrol agents at the scene of the shooting January 24th were wearing body cameras, a Reuters view of the verified video showed. Reuters could not determine if the cameras were activated or if any agents involved in the physical encounter were wearing them. When ICE or Border Patrol have engaged in acts of violence, including the fatal shootings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty in Minneapolis, top Trump officials have been quick to label the deceased as aggressors rather than call for thorough investigations. Trump has started ramping up immigration enforcement this year after Republicans in Congress passed a bill last year that provides $170 billion for the crackdown, a major funding surge expected to transform the way ICE and Border Patrol operate. White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, the architect of Trump's immigration agenda, called Pretty a domestic terrorist and a would-be assassin in social media posts hours after he was fatally shot by a Border Patrol agent. ICE launched a body cam pilot program in 2024 and deployed cameras to officers in five cities: Baltimore, Buffalo, Detroit, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. While the Trump administration kept the program, it called on Congress to freeze its expansion and slash funds to run it in its budget request for fiscal year 2026. As if the state's unemployment relief system was not already among the worst in the nation, new legislation aims to make it worse. Florida pays out the fewest weeks of unemployment benefits at 12 and the lowest maximum amount per week at $275. But GOP lawmakers want to impose more verification requirements for claimants to crack down on fraud. I just don't see that there's any reason why we should be trying to make sure all fraud is taken care of in a situation like this, said Senator Stan McClain, Republican from Ocala and sponsor of SB 216. The bill requires the Department of Commerce, which operates the state's reemployment system, as it was dubbed in 2012, to deny claims to applicants who don't contact five employers per week, fail to appear for three scheduled job interviews, or don't return to work when recalled from a temporary layoff. Also, every 2 weeks, the department must verify each claimant is alive, not in jail, and not employed. The bill passed on a party line 9-5 vote through the Senate Appropriations Committee on Tourism, Transportation, and Economic Development, with Democrats pointing to Florida's already stingy jobless benefit system and expressing skepticism that the measure is needed to combat fraud. It's just a lot of bureaucratic hurdles for them to go through, said Senator Carlos Guillermo Smith, Democrat from Orlando, who also noted that even if a claimant receives the maximum $275 per week, it wouldn't pay for most people's basic expenses. The part of the bill rejecting claims if someone doesn't show up for an interview was also questioned by Richard Jones, Secretary Treasurer for the Florida State Building and Construction Trades Council, who said his union's members work on projects and often face temporary layoffs and interact with many prospective employers. Having to take a lower-paying job to keep their jobless benefits intact will depress their wages, he argued. Our members are not sitting around ignoring interviews. They're waiting for skilled trade-specific work that matches their certifications, their training, and their safety standards we enforce, Jones told the committee. Florida's unemployment system has struggled to cope with surges in claims, including during the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, when the system was overrun and claimants faced months of delays. McClain, though, argued that the funding lawmakers approved in the wake of that eased the issues with approving claims, and the bill is still needed to weed out fraudulent claims. I believe structurally we've fixed the unemployment system, McClain said. All we're asking is that they go out and contact the number of employers they're supposed to. But Senator Tina Pawlenty, Democrat from Boca Raton, warned Florida could soon see a surge of jobless claims from people losing high-paying jobs because of artificial intelligence, and questioned whether the system could weather a new inundation of claims. Going forward, if we're setting up a new system with this bill, we're going to be facing a lot more problems, and a lot of jobs are not going to be easily filled, Pawlenty said. We might be facing a deluge of people losing their jobs, and we're only setting up the system to fail, to make it even harder for these people. The bill was one more committee hurdle for the Senate, but the House version, HB 191, is ready for the floor vote in that chamber. Opposition to building a cruise ship port in Manatee County grows. Opposition is building to a proposed cruise port terminal south of the Sunshine Skyway. Around 12,000 people have signed a petition against the idea, saying it would ruin the area's fragile ecosystem. SSA Marine says the terminal at Terracea is needed because larger cruise ships can't go under the bridge to Port Tampa Bay or Seaport Manatee. But that has rattled fishers and environmental advocates, who say that the area around Paradise Island and Rattlesnake Key is ecologically sensitive. Corey McKeever, who operates a boat repair business in Bradenton, started the petition. He says a channel would have to be dredged at least 50 feet deep, killing seagrasses. There's not much seagrass left in Tampa Bay. That is one of the only places that is still left and they want to build a cruise port that needs a minimum of 50, 60 feet of water, dredge up preserve and build a giant cruise port there, he said. And you can't tell me that that's not going to release toxins from when the oil was spilled in the bay in the 70s and in the 90s. And what about Piney Point? Those toxins aren't going to be removed from the ground when they start digging and dredging and then destroy the whole environment. McKeever said the terminal would significantly harm his business and disrupt fish nurseries far into the bay. I'm going to either go out of business because of them, or I'm going to die trying, he said. That's it. Plain and simple. They will put me out of business. There will be no water for us to enjoy. People will sell their boats because they'll just go on a cruise ship because the water is black. There'll be no fishing. McKeever believes it will destroy at least 50% of his business the day they start dredging. So all the fishermen that I work on, all their boats, and I do a lot of repairs on these people's boats, they're not going to have business because there's no fish, McKeever said. SSA estimates the construction phase of the project would generate more than 31,000 jobs statewide and regionally, both directly and indirectly, and boost labor earnings by about $1.6 billion. Cruise operations, the company said, would also support jobs in hospitality, transportation, logistics, and maritime services. A rally in opposition to the plan will be held at 11 a.m. February 14th at Seabreeze Park, 55 Horseshoe Loop in Terracea. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WVPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my interview with Anders Croy, Communications Director for Florida Watch.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm happy to welcome back Anders Croy, Communications Director for Florida Watch, which is a communications and research organization with Digital First Lens, relaunched in the spring of 2020. They serve a progressive community's in-state hub for message development, digital communications, and research. Thanks for coming on today, Anders. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Lou, and thank you so much for having me on to speak with you and your listeners today.
Yeah, you know, I think today, you know, we're going to have to touch on some things that they're talking about up in Tallahassee. As, you know, most of my listeners probably know. You know, there is a legislative session, going on right now, and among many things to talk about is what's going to happen when somebody starts trying to build AI centers in Florida. As you've all heard, you know, they draw an enormous amount of energy and water. And, as we've seen with the last bout of power regulation, FPNL, got to do the biggest increase in history, I guess. So what is going on with that?
It's a huge issue that, as you mentioned, it hasn't really hit here in Florida that much yet. There is debate obviously going on right now about artificial intelligence, AI itself, and the future of that technology. There is legislation moving called the AI Bill of Rights that is being supported unanimously right now by Republicans and Democrats. Also drew support from the Florida AFL-CIO as it moved through committee this week. But the thing is, when it comes to AI technology, we then have to think about, well, how do we power that? And the way that is powered is through what are called AI data centers. And these are massive complexes that in some cases can consume as much energy as a small city. There is one being built right now in Michigan that projections say the power that will be used for that data center could power more than a million homes in that general area. Now, as I said, this hasn't been a huge issue yet in Florida. We do not have a lot of what are these called hyperscale data centers. But back in October, plans were revealed for one of the largest data centers in the world to be built on some agricultural land in St. Lucie County. Now, every place that we have seen these data centers pop up, we have seen intense, fierce, local, bipartisan pushback against them. And why is that? It's because there are many negative impacts that come to communities with these data centers. Top of that list is, as we just mentioned, their power consumption has led to skyrocketing utility costs for the communities where these have been placed. This became a huge issue in gubernatorial races last year in the state of Virginia, in the state of New Jersey, and it's been a big issue in local races all throughout the country. A big example of this would be Northern Virginia, where Prince William County has really become the epicenter of the data center boom in this country. And you saw Republicans and Democrats on both sides of the aisle in state legislative races there running ads about how the other side was too close with the people building these data centers. Because it's also not just those skyrocketing utility costs that come along with it. There are environmental impacts to this. These data centers can consume up to 5 million gallons of water per day. You did not hear me wrong. 5 million gallons of water per day. That can drain local water supplies as well as increasing greenhouse gas emissions. They create electronic and toxic waste runoff, and they generate noise pollution from the constant hum of these servers that impact surrounding neighborhoods, which also has to do with the third major impact. It's the quality of life. For someone who lives in a neighborhood, you know, there are photos from Northern Virginia where they have built these data centers and they are towering over Little League fields where they are humming 24/7 outside of people's residential homes, right over schools, places that you take your children. So right now what we're trying to do is make sure that people are aware that as we start to set regulations for these AI data centers, if they are going to come to Florida, that it is done in a transparent method. Because data center deals are often rushed through with secrecy, with tax giveaways, and pressure from powerful corporations. But these communities deserve transparency, they deserve their local impact, and they deserve to make real decision-making power as these decisions are being made for them. So what we're trying to get the word out on is SB 1118. That's SB 1118. We're calling that the Data Centers Secrecy Act. And what this bill would do is it would create a one-year public records exemption for data center planning records held by local cities and counties. This means that your local county commission, your local city commission, could keep you in the dark about the fact that they are in negotiations to bring a data center to your backyard. We think that's wrong. We think politicians shouldn't sell out communities and local control to big tech behind closed doors. And we think that data centers shouldn't just make wealthy tech executives and corporations even richer, while local communities are paying the price through higher utility bills, water shortages, pollution, and lost quality of life. So what we want to do is make sure that people are reaching out, talking to their state legislators about this bill as it moves through the process. It right now has passed through one committee in the Senate by a 7-1 vote. So we want to make sure that people know, I need to talk to my state senator. I need to talk to my state representative and tell them, if you're going to try to bring data centers to my community, I want to make sure it's done in a transparent method and that we have the ability to push back and to make sure that we are getting the best deal possible for our community, not what's best for these big tech executives and these wealthy billionaire fat cats.
Yeah, that seems to be pretty important, even though they claim that, they're going to want to, with regulation, you know, push most of the cost of this back onto the tech companies that want to build these things and, of course, will benefit from them financially. But you know, as I mentioned in my earlier remarks, you know, Floridians' experience with, the legislature or the government in Florida and their ability to regulate, big utility, usually they side with big utility, So this is something that's, worth really keeping an eye on. Just out of curiosity, do we know of any proposals for data centers here in Florida?
Well, as I mentioned, that data center that's been announced now in St. Lucie County would be one of the largest ever built anywhere in the entire world. And there has already been organized pushback from ranchers in that area who are worried about the destruction of agricultural land there. And in fact, that pushback, that organized pushback that they saw from these ranchers has led the Palm Beach County Commission to delay a vote on approval of a smaller data center that had been planned in a community down there. So I think people are waking up to this. We are starting to see a little bit more of this creep of it coming down here to the state of Florida. But as you mentioned, you know, the unintended costs of this, because in many cases, these data centers, when you build them, they are going to require a ton of new power. That's going to require infrastructure investments. That's going to require probably a lot more money on the front end and then on the back end as well. You know, a study that looked at some of these data centers in the Midwest by PGM, or PJM, which is the company that helps a lot of Mid-Atlantic and Ohio Valley states, showed that they had an estimated $9.3 billion cost in added electricity fees. That is being mostly passed on to consumers, and we want to make sure that's not the case here in Florida. We also want to make sure that people aren't giving these companies massive tax giveaways for what turns out to a lot of time be a short-term sugar high of economic benefits. There may be a lot of construction jobs while these data centers are being built, but what we know in the long run is it doesn't take that many people to run these things. They're mostly run off-site and remotely. So while you may have a economic impact on the front end, you're going to see lost tax revenue as the housing prices are going to fall. You're going to be taking agricultural land out of use that could have been used for economic benefit. You're going to take out land that could have been used for building small businesses in your area. And you're going to see a real loss of tax revenue down the line while these companies continue to get richer and people in Florida, their quality of life will suffer.
Yeah, geez, you know, you kind of read my mind. You know, my next question was going to be how many, you know, the usual carrot that, you know, these sort of projects offer is jobs. But, yeah, you know, you answered my question. I knew there was going to be, like, a lot of jobs when they're building them. But, you know, how many guys does it take to run one of those things? Because it is automated, right? I mean, it's...
Typically just a few dozen people at the most. So you're not talking about long-term high-paying jobs in a local community. What you're talking about is an eyesore that's probably going to suck up electricity. You know, Florida, to quote the Florida Tax Watch, which put out a report last year, Florida is sort of barreling towards a water shortage here. With so many people moving to the state over the last few years, we all rely on getting our water from the Floridan aquifer. Having something that's going to suck up to 5 million gallons a day, it's just not sustainable for the environmental future of our state either. We all deserve clean drinking water and not for people to be benefiting and making massive profits off of that while we're seeing higher utility costs on water, on electricity, on everything that goes along with these data centers.
You know, you're absolutely right. That massive use of water is critical because, you know, anybody who is, I guess, you know, read about the environment here in Florida knows that, what keeps the aquifer pure is a certain tension between, you know, saltwater infusion and the size of the aquifer. When you start taking too much water out of it, which I think we saw in a couple of areas in Florida, particularly on the East Coast, that were overdeveloped, it started to get tainted because too much water was being used. And this could be, you know, I mean, the numbers you're talking about are phenomenal. I mean, that's more than, you know, we talk about overdevelopment in Florida. This would be like, you know, putting a bunch of mega developments out all at once, right? I mean, the amount of water these things use.
Absolutely. I mean, it could create an existential crisis for the future of the state when it comes to our water supplies. But also, as we mentioned, the other environmental impacts of this. Toxic runoff, things of that nature, you know, as they're building these. Plus, you know, you are taking out what was agricultural land, conservation land in a lot of places. So it's really something that we need to be studying to make sure that local communities are getting the best deal if these are going to be coming to town. And that's why we, again, think it is so important that people are reaching out to their representatives, reaching out to their senators, and telling them to vote no on the Data Center Secrecy Act, because people deserve to be informed. They deserve a transparent process. And they deserve to know that their elected representatives are putting what's best for them first and making sure that we are keeping our electricity costs down, protecting our environmental treasures, and preserving that Florida way of life that we all have come to love so much for generations to come.
Okay, I just want to interrupt for a second. For those just tuning in, this is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Anders Croy, Communications Director for Florida Watch. Yeah, I know there was an executive order that was signed. I don't know. Last year, late in the year, you know, by the president. You know, that was basically discouraging states from regulating AI development at all. And I think that had more to do with regulating content. But do you know if that also, you know, is you know, something that you know, maybe preventing a state like Florida from, you know, regulating the power and water use of AI centers built here?
Well, as you mentioned, that executive order from the president last year was really him trying to take a second bite at the apple. In the Republican budget bill that passed last summer, there had initially been a 10-year moratorium on states trying to regulate AI at the state level. Now, that was eventually pulled from the bill, but the president was upset about that. And we need to be very clear about why the president is upset about that. It's because he is backed by billionaires in the tech industry, big tech, who have given his campaign and his political causes hundreds of millions of dollars. This is not something where I don't think the president actually feels very strongly policy-wise, but it is something where the people who back his political ambitions, who have helped him return to the office of the presidency and who have been very loyal in their fealty to him over this first year in office, have a big swing on what they're trying to do here. Now, that has put him a little bit on a collision course with Florida's governor. Governor DeSantis, I will say, actually, to his credit, for the last year has been talking about potential dangers of AI when it comes to consumer protections, when it comes to how this impacts our children. And he did put forward his own AI Bill of Rights that is now being pushed and carried by Senator Tom Leak in the Florida Senate. That's the bill I mentioned. It did pass unanimously. There are good consumer protections in that bill. There are still questions around how this would impact workers who are potentially displaced by AI in years to come. But what the argument for Florida is making when it comes to the AI Bill of Rights is that, you know, we are doing consumer protections. We're not actually regulating the technology itself. Now, that is something I guess they're going to have to fight about in the courts. The president's executive order did say that he would try to cut off federal funding to states that put forward their own AI regulations. But again, that is kind of part and parcel outside of the conversation about the data centers themselves, because in order to power that technology, that's where you have to build the data centers. And we are trying to make sure that as we're building those data centers and building them out, that Floridians are getting the best deal in that process. And a lot of times that may mean that they keep these things out of their communities as a whole. As I mentioned before, this is not a left or right issue. This is a bipartisan issue where we have seen people in deep red states. I will point to a Oklahoma Trump-supporting farmer who put up a sign on his land that he made himself that said Jesus was born on ag land. There have been arguments about this in Indiana, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and many times what you're seeing is local communities saying absolutely not to these huge data center projects, and we're continuing to see people push back, and we want to make sure that Floridians are informed about what's coming to their local communities here in the future.
Yeah, you know, it sounds to me like, you know, it's kind of impossible, even if the builders of the data centers, you know, absorb, you know, all the expense, say, you know, for, you know, increasing electricity production, you know, there's only a certain amount of water, you know, so whether they're going to pay for it or not, you know, I don't think it matters, you know, for people that live in that area, you know,
exactly.
In agricultural areas.
It is, and, you know, outside of even these environmental impacts, the increasing cost of electricity, I think we should all be able to agree that our government should have to operate in the sunshine. You know, one of the people who is pushing back against this bill is the First Amendment Foundation here in the state of Florida, and their executive director, Bobby Block, noting about this bill, said this would allow the early stages of negotiation and project planning, when zoning, infrastructure, commitments, and public incentives are often effectively decided, to occur in the dark. Residents, journalists, and watchdog organizations would be unable to see preliminary plans or expressed intentions prior to formal filings. That's not the way government is supposed to operate, especially here in the state of Florida, where we have some of the strongest sunshine laws in the country. Creating a public records exemption that will benefit one industry specifically is against what we think of as our ideals of how government should work here. We should be doing what's best for the people, not what's best for these giant corporations and the billionaires who are backing them, who are making these massive profits off the backs of our local communities.
that, you know. And what's also incredible too is that the more we learn about AI, you know, it's not the magic bullet that you know AI producers like to make it out to be. You know, if you've ever tried to use ChatGPT or some of these other things, you know, other sites, you know, you find out that they aren't really reliable. Basically, you know, they make a lot of stuff up. So, which isn't, this is a side point. It's got nothing to do with this issue, of course.
There's certainly concerns with the technology as a whole. But, you know, today as we think about who's going to power it and how communities are going to be affected, we want to make sure that people have the ability to have all of the facts as we think about what that means for all of us in the future.
Speaking of having all the facts and knowing what's going on, I mean, this is an important issue that people need to be keeping an eye on. But another issue that's, you know, creeping up is, redistricting. I know that I guess earlier this week or maybe last week or something, you know, the first sort of step in that process started when the House Committee on Redistricting, talked about it. What's that process? What do we need to look at there for the state of Florida?
Every Floridian should be aware that right now, in response to President Trump asking red states to gerrymander their districts to try to preserve his extremely thin legislative majority that he has in the United States House, that Republican leadership here in Florida is reacting to that. Now, at the moment, the House of Representatives here in Florida has convened a select committee on redistricting. That committee has met a couple of times. They have not put forward any maps yet. But what the governor has asked for and has already actually declared that there will be a special session in April of this year. Now, the governor is making a lot of excuses for why we would do this special session on redistricting. But I want to make it very clear to your listeners about what is happening here in Florida. Back in 2010, more than 60% of Floridians passed the Fair Districts Amendment. They did that because redistricting decides who represents us in government, and it's a process that must serve the people and not politicians. We explicitly in Florida outlawed political gerrymandering, drawing districts to benefit one political party or another in our state constitution. What they are proposing to do right now in Florida is to gerrymander districts in direct opposition to our Constitution. Any attempt to draw a new vote for the next election in our state is a direct response to the president's request, and that is illegal in Florida. And I want to make that point over and over, because you are going to hear and have already heard a lot of excuses, Governor, from Republican leadership in this state about why they are going to do redistricting, but it is clear why they're doing this. And they are doing this solely to benefit the Republicans. They are doing it in response to the president's call for governors, Republican-held states, to do congressional redistricting in May. But that is illegal under Florida state constitution. Now, it doesn't matter what you might see happen in other, what happens in California, what happens in Texas. Their constitutions in those do not explicitly outlaw gerrymandering. But the people of Florida spoke, and they spoke loudly, and they spoke together when they outlawed gerrymandering here. And we should be pushing back against these representatives, against these state senators, against the governor, against anyone who would try to illegally gerrymander the state of Florida ahead of our next round of redistricting that is supposed to occur after the 2030 census.
Yeah, you know, and I guess it's worth mentioning that, you know, here in Florida, you know, they're looking at maybe perhaps gaining a seat because they've already only a seat because they've already gerrymandered the state, you know, so well that, you know, they already control most of the congressional districts, and that it might turn out to be a dummy mander if they actually got away with it because, you know, they might, you know, move the line the wrong way, you know, and lose some seats. So, you know, that's just a comment.
It could, but again, without even getting into the
politics of how this
it's illegal. That is the main thing that I think folks should take away from this. What they are trying to do here is a direct contradiction to what you as Floridians and as voters told them that you wanted and what our state constitution says.
You know, we need to keep an eye on that because, you know, he has called for that and it is, and I guess, you know, like the House is, you know, working on something, You know, but we'll find out, I guess, by the end of the session, you know, where that leads. Probably, and this is probably the last issue that we probably ought to talk about today, just for a second anyway, is, you know, the status of eliminating property tax. I know to eliminate property tax altogether would require a constitutional amendment, but, you know, aren't they trying to, you know, have some other ways where they can lower property tax, you know, but that, you know, communities will vote on it? What do we know about that?
As you mentioned, so property taxes are in Florida's constitution. The only way that they could eliminate or get rid of or even make any changes to how property taxes are collected here in the state would require a constitutional amendment that more than 60% of Floridians would have to support. The governor, for almost a year now, has been talking about his plan. He initially started out by saying he wanted to eliminate all property taxes. Well, I think he came to sort of the reality that that would not be workable, that local communities cannot take that type of hit and still be able to function and provide the services that they are expecting from their local governments. Now, he then started talking about getting rid of just homesteaded property taxes. Now, that would still be a huge hit for these local communities and the things that they rely on. So what we've seen is that the House has, again, put together a select committee on property taxes. They moved through that select committee seven different proposals to potentially put on the ballot. Three of those are now set to go to the floor of the House to be voted on by the full body there. Now, the Senate has not done any work on this yet. The Senate president seems to be more aligned with the governor, and they have been waiting for him to put out his own plan. The governor is still trying to figure out what that plan is. But I want to be kind of really clear about what's happening here, too. Hardworking families and seniors across our state, they deserve real solutions to this affordability crisis. But if you eliminate property taxes, you're just going to saddle people with higher costs while handing big profits to corporations for services that are currently public, affordable, and working for us. Because this is not a tax shift, or this is not a tax cut. What this will be is a tax shift. We've already heard local governments, local communities talk about the fact that, you know, if these cuts go through, if this elimination of homesteaded property taxes goes through, you're going to see things like your public parks becoming potentially pay-for-play. Libraries will be shut down. Public health services that people rely on will not be funded anymore. Things like EMS and firefighters, you know, disaster preparedness, things that people rely on are going to become more expensive. And that'll become more expensive in the form of either new taxes or new fees that will either be charged by your local government or that will then be outsourced to a corporation who probably will charge you more money, will make more profit, and will not deliver the exact same level of service that you are used to for more money out of your own pocket. We need to make sure that as we are moving through this process, we are looking at the real affordability crisis that is facing Floridians. And, you know, the Florida Policy Institute has done a lot of really good work. They are an economic think tank here in Florida, nonpartisan, that looks at how these cuts would potentially impact local communities. And they released a finding from a recent Mason-Dixon poll that asked Floridians head-to-head, what would you rather have, property tax relief or property insurance relief? More than 60% of Floridians said they want property insurance relief right now. So what you're seeing here has really been a distraction by the governor, by Republican leadership in the state, who have done nothing but actually give insurance companies more than $3 billion in taxpayer-funded bailouts and making it almost impossible for consumers to sue them when their disaster strikes and they don't make good on legitimate claims over the last few years. Property insurance in the state of Florida has increased by where we are paying almost five times the national average now. What has Republicans been doing while those insurance companies have been price gouging people out of their home? Well, the governor and Republican leadership in Florida have taken more than $10 million from those same insurance companies. What we could be doing right now to actually put money back into people's pockets that they could use would be capping rate hikes or taxing insurance companies' excess profits so hardworking Floridians can protect what they've built and our first-time homebuyers get their shot at the American dream. But instead, what we're seeing is an attempt to weaken local communities instead of taking on the predatory insurance corporations that have really been putting people in a bad position by taking money out of their pocket at exorbitant rates over the last few years in Florida.
So, you know, I want to thank you, Anders Croy, for making time for us today. And, you know, tell my listeners how they can learn more about this and important other issues from Florida Watch and
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Lou. And if you want to learn more about our organization, you can go to floridawatch.org. That's floridawatch.org. You can find all of our social media channels, find out more about us, and sign up for our email list to become part of the fight to build a brighter, better future for all Floridians.
Beautiful. Thanks again, Andrews. You have a great day.
Thank you, Lou. You as well.
Neil Young is giving the people of Greenland the gift of song. His songs, that is. The veteran rocker announced this week on a blog that he is providing free access to his entire music catalog to residents of Denmark's semi-autonomous territory, whose futures have lately become a point of tension between the U.S. and NATO. I hope my music and music films will ease some of the unwarranted stress and threats you are experiencing from our unpopular and hopefully temporary government, Young wrote. It is my sincere wish for you to be able to enjoy all of my music in your beautiful Greenland home in its highest quality. The offer is for a year, though Young said renewing it is possible, and applicants need to have a Greenland-based cell phone. This is an offer of peace and love, he wrote. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Thanks to Anders Croy from Florida Watch for making time for us this week, and stay tuned for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.